You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, my looms,
my luminaries out there,
what's up?
Listen,
we're doing something totally different today. I decided to start recording the show in my art studio. And so this is my wall. So every time we have a guest, I'm going to paint their name. So our guest today's name is up there. I'm going to announce it in a moment. So first of all, shout out to our sponsor, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, 818-571-1508. He will take care of all of your needs, and he is always available for you to talk to. And shout out to those who choose love over chaos. It's a beautiful world. We're all attempting to love each other. It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect, but at least we can do our best to try. So today, I have the wonderful pleasure. It's hard to wrap around a man who truly needs no introduction, but his resume needs an introduction. He has done everything. He's an author, journalist, and ultimate Hollywood correspondent. His name is Nelson Aspin. I painted his name up on the wall behind me so that you can all see it's in bright red. And we can bring Nelson on now. Hey, Nelson.
Thank you for having me back. And I'm very impressed. I get to be your first name on the wall.
You're my first painted name on the wall. And it's beautiful, you guys. If the camera could go close up, I did my calligraphy thing. For those of you who don't know, I used to have to do temp jobs as a calligraphist, and it was really hard, so I stopped doing it. But I'm back. So let's talk to Nelson. Nelson, let's get right into it. First of all, you have interviewed just about everybody that I could think of. I saw your list that your rep was so wonderful to send over to me. So Hugh Jackman, Miley Cyrus, all these famous people, Susan Sarandon, Tony Bennett, you know, all of these wonderful people that you've interviewed. How have you been able to maintain such close personal ties with people like Jamie Lee Curtis? And tell her I love her. She's one of my favorites. So with Jamie Lee Curtis and people like that, how have you been able to maintain those ties?
Well, I'm a very lucky guy. I feel like someone described it to me recently. She said to me, Nelson, you are a friend collector. And I thought, what a lovely thing to say. I feel like I am a friend collector. And I'm not saying that all these celebrities that I've interviewed are personal friends, far from it. But I think by behaving like a friend and being trustworthy, and I'm not a gotcha kind of journalist. I'm not a suck up either, but I'm fair and I'm punctual. I'm polite. I shave. I consider myself relatively well-groomed. So once I establish a rapport with any given celebrity, they tend to want to see me again. For instance, I got to interview Julie Andrews 8 times. It was extraordinary. And, who knows? I mean, we're both still around. There could be a 9th or a 10th time. But she would request me for certain interview opportunities because she trusted me. And that's a real honor and a privilege. So I always feel that. And a lot of celebrity reporters, you can't name them because they have very short shelf lives, because if they get their hands dirty with the gossip or the gotcha, they don't last long. So I've been around. I started working in the 60s, and now I'm in my 60s. So I must be doing something right.
60s is a new 30 and 40. Haven't you heard that already?
Yeah, well, I'll take whatever I can get. I'm still, I remember one time my very, very elderly in her 90s grandmother was causing trouble in the house at some point, and somebody asked my mother, what's with her? And my mother replied, she's still breathing. But that's what I feel like. I'm still breathing, so I'm going to keep going.
You're doing it. Wow. So how long, if there is a length or if there is just a time period of the process, does it take, do they trust you automatically because you're a correspondent, or did it take interview after interview to develop the trust over time so that you can go to lunch with a Jamie Lee Curtis, so that you can do something with them outside of a job or what you're doing this work?
Absolutely. I mean, it's life is a constant proving ground. You're constantly proving yourself and living up to your reputation. If you have a good reputation, you have to make sure to live up to it, because it only takes one slip up to ruin everything, especially nowadays where we have social media in our faces all the time. Jamie Lee Curtis is an interesting example because it was in the early 90s. I think it was the early 90s. I had just moved to Los Angeles the first time, and I was hired as a guest star on her then sitcom, which was called Anything But Love. She co-starred with Richard Lewis, and I was a guest star on an episode of that. And she was a very different lady back then. She, you know, that was before she got sober. It was not a happy set. Flash forward to many years later, when I was now a reporter, not just acting, and I was a reporter, and I said to her, I was like, oh, I haven't seen you in years. We did Anything But Love together. And that degree of separation made us bond. And then every time after that, you know, that I would interview her or see her or travel to do interviews and segments with her. So time counts. Which is why I find it ironic that show business is so ageist. Eventually, I had my last reporting job that I had was for 20 years. And then on a Friday night, the boss called me and said, we don't need you anymore. You know, it was a financial thing, but I think it was also an age thing. Financial, because I'd been there so long, I was at, you know, I was at my top of earning. Like, they could get somebody new, and everybody puts their hand up to be on television. You know, so they could get some kid in there that would work basically for free because they just want to be on TV or have this amazing opportunity, which of course it is. But ageism is real. It's not just budget, but that's how it goes. I can't change my age. I can only celebrate it.
Embrace it. You can only embrace it. And, you know, and I'm a huge advocate for people not judging people because of ages and colors and lifestyles and all that. It's so ignorant to me. I'm serious. It really bugs me when people do that. Number one, everyone has to get old. So that's kind of silly, in my opinion.
If it were
the fact that people could stay young forever, then yeah, I could see that point. But the truth is not true. And the second thing is that there are more young people dying than ever before. They're going back and getting people like you and other people like myself, who have proven the test of time. We're not sick. We are comfortable in our own skin. We have wisdom. You know, we've learned and gone through processes, which brings me to my next question. You are releasing the third book in your trilogy, Dancing Between Raindrops, Happily Ever After. How do you feel about completing this part of your writing career? And then we're going to talk about your next stage that you're writing.
The Dancing Between the Raindrops trilogy. My life was so full that it required three books to tell my story. The first book, Dancing Between the Raindrops, chronicles my early days in New York City in the 80s when I was pursuing Broadway. And they're very racy. These are for adults.
You were a cabaret dancer, right?
I was a singer. I was a singer, and I'm still singing, which is marvelous and wonderful. And then Dancing Between the Raindrops, The Hollywood Years, that was the second installment. And then now the third and final one is out, and it's called Dancing Between the Raindrops, Happily Ever After, with a question mark, because spoiler alert, I'm happy.
Definitely.
But that,
why
that's
are you...
That, that's, I thought it was a good place to end with my happily ever after. It's like, remember Sex in the City was one of my favorite shows, but when they rebooted it without Kim Cattrall and did the updated and just like that sort of sequel like series, it was so depressing to me, because here were these characters we loved and we stayed with for all those years, and now they were in their 50s and 60s. But the show was such a downer. It was all about erectile dysfunction, deafness, incontinence, hip problems. It was so, it is not reflective of my experience of being over 50 whatsoever. So I appreciate that I got to do a joyful part three. So I invite people to check out the whole series. And you don't have to read all three or read them in order. Each book stands on its own, and it's full of juicy celebrity stuff and compelling coming-of-age stories, whether you want to look at me in the 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s.
I'd like to look at you anywhere I can. I don't care.
Well, now you're looking at me in the 60s.
That is so funny. The way it came out, but I'm like, I don't mind whatever span you've had. I'm glad that you appeared on my timeline, because I would have missed the opportunity to meet such a wonderful, gracious heart as yours. So
take one to know one, you know.
Yeah, it does take one to know one. But anyway, what I wanted to do is talk to you a little bit more about ending that chapter. Now, you've gone from, first of all, how do we live happily ever after? How did you come up with, we can live happily ever after? Is there a formula to live happily after? Or is that what happened from you going through the process of your life?
I think the latter. It's really an attitude. Living well is the best revenge. So, and I've gotten through life by shrugging my shoulders whenever anything goes wrong and saying, that's showbiz. You don't have to be in show business to use that phrase to help you get through things, because it's basically saying that's life and stuff happens. And if your attitude is, hey, we got to keep going. And I'm even if I've had a really bad day and I'm grumpy, I somehow get even grumpier knowing I get mad at myself, because I'm like, you know what, Nelson, you're just going to wake up tomorrow happy, you idiot. You're just going to bound out of bed happy, which I do every morning. I'm a morning person. What can I say? And it's just, it's my nature. And you can't, I don't know, there's no recipe for happy. Human nature, but I choose to be happy.
It's a choice. It's a choice. I was just going to say, it's a choice to be happy. And you know, the resilience and discipline that one has to develop in the mind in order to have that mood overcome all the other levels of our personality that we can experience. Okay. So you went from, I find this extremely interesting. I love your personality. Went from reporting facts. A journalist, they've got to be accurate facts. These are people that if you make one mistake, you could get canned for the rest of your life. Two, a very playful thing like the magnificent Mr. and Mrs. Maple. That is so cute. It's launching people on Earth Day, April 22nd. Isn't that cute?
Yeah.
It's a children's book.
It is my first children. It's my 12th book, but my first children's book, because as I said, my other novels are definitely not for children. So much so, in fact, that my editor said, would you like to use a pen name for the children's book? Because people associate you with these rather racy, steamy stories. And I was like, no, I think I'm comfortable using my own name. I'm capable of writing two styles of literature. And I'm very proud of it. The book is available now, The Magnificent Mr. and Mrs. Maple. And I wanted it to be out before Earth Day, because it's all set in my garden. And it's all about the flora and fauna of my garden. Now, I live in Harlem, New York City. Directly across the street from me is the Apollo Theater. I look out at the Apollo Marquee, which is amazing. And I think you've got your smoke alarm going off, your battery and your smoke alarm. I think that's what that tweeting sound is.
That beep. I'm so sorry, you guys. I didn't even know it was on.
Hey, when we get off the air, you'll change your battery. It's all right.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
It's like having the birds tweeting overhead. So, but yeah, my beautiful garden that I've created as part of my happily ever after, I have two maple trees. And I nicknamed them Mr. and Mrs. Maple. And that gave me the idea for the book. And the theme of the book, it's a significant book. This isn't like a quick thing you read 10 minutes and then you're done. This is a storybook that will take you several nights probably at bedtime to read, but it's about family, a family of plants and critters.
Trees.
But the message is that a family does not need to all live under the same roof to be a family. And that, you know, I come from a blended family, so I know what that means. And every family eventually faces an older folk who has to maybe go into a nursing home or assisted living. So it's not about being under the same roof. There are invisible bonds that keep you together. And that's the message of the book. And I have the foreword to the book is written by a renowned gerontologist, Carrie Burnight. She had a best-selling book about, her best-selling book was called Joy Span. And it was about that as you get older, it's not about, oh my God, I've got to live a number of years. It's about the quality of those years, whether you're 80 or 90 or 100. And so with that forward to the book, I thought, oh, we've got to get this book, not just story time for kids, but into nursing homes and adult living communities and have kids read it to the old folks and have old folks read it to the kids, because it's that universal message. And I'm really proud of that.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful. Now, what do you want children? What are children going to get out of the book? Because it is a children's book. And I love that you made it your own by putting it, by making it about your own garden and with your own fauna and flora. What are you expecting the next generation or children and their parents to get out of the Maples story?
Well, the book is not written, I don't write down. I'm not talking down to my audience. The book is full of excellent vocabulary. Yeah. I think a compelling love story. But so it doesn't matter if you're a small child or an older child, or maybe you're a teenager or an adult reading it to a younger child. So it has these child appealing characters. Besides Mr. and Mrs. Maple, there's Nosy, who is a very busybody bee who flies around and he visits them, as does a pigeon, a New York City pigeon named Joro, which is named for my husband, who's terrified of pigeons. So I thought, I'll show him. I'm gonna make a pigeon and call it
a pigeon.
So he's a pigeon. And then there's a silly spider named Sally, who flies in and out on her web. So this is this little family, and the bushes, there's a juniper bush, there's a boxwood bush, and they make up this patchwork family. So it's fun for the kids, and I have to tell you, Osiris, the illustrations are
marvelous.
Next level. I mean, I don't want to hold it, but it's...
I see even the cover...
The cover is magnificent. I mean, these are frameable pieces of art. And the young woman who did it, Nicole Tejada, she just did a marvelous job. I had her come over to my garden, and we took photographs of all my plants and bushes and everything. And we collaborated until we got the art the way we wanted it. And I'm delighted. So yeah, kids can just look at the pictures and enjoy it.
Wow. I mean, you just blow me away. I love you guys. I am so sorry. I don't know if the audience can hear it. I actually thought it was birds chirping because I am in my studio and the birds are chirping outside. So, you know, we'll get it fixed. So please don't let it be an annoyance, because as long as we can hear Nelson talk.
We all know what that. We all know what that's like. At least at least the alarm's not going off.
Yeah, I didn't even think, but I didn't think about what I thought it was one of the birds. I'm like, wow, they're loud. But anyway, now. What is it? Kindred spirits?
A Titanic tale.
What is it about the
Titanic? This is the last time I saw you.
I know, but what is it about the Titanic that continues to inspire people and keep their imagination going so much, you guys, to the point that Netflix is interested?
And talking to
Nelson about
everybody, everybody under the sun is interested in Titanic, peripherally, as an entertainment factor or history or artwork or something. And you and I met in person last April 15th of 2025 when I was releasing my book, Kindred Spirits, A Titanic Tale, in Los Angeles. And you came to the launch party. That was the first time we met in person. And that, you know, April 15th is the anniversary. This April 15th of 2026 is the 114th anniversary of Titanic. And I've had a year since coming out with that book. I've traveled the world promoting the book. I've been a guest speaker on everything from the Queen Mary to speaking over the wreck site. I've been speaking at exhibitions, and I've got one in New York coming up this week, this weekend. And I'm leading a tour to Ireland, to Belfast, to the Titanic Museum. I mean, Titanic is the gift that keeps on going. You know, they said the ship was unsinkable when they were proven wrong right away on the maiden voyage. However, the legacy of Titanic is unsinkable. People just gravitate to it generation after generation, after generation. And my book, as we discussed last time we were doing the show, it's a historical fantasy based on my past life beliefs. If it's not a true past life, it's at least my obsession with a particular first-class passenger who perished and the similarities that he and I experienced. So that's what Kindred Spirits is about. And what's marvelous, and it's great that people love the book, continue to love the book. It's a little bit of my Titanic legacy because I have a podcast called Titanic Talk. And
I didn't know that.
Yes, I'm
look
everywhere.
Look at you. You just something else.
So unbelievably, the Netflix series Titan, the Oceangate disaster, which was a huge hit for Netflix, about the submersible that tragically imploded diving down to Titanic. One of the executive producers on that series came to me. He had actually dove? He actually dove to the wreck site three times in that submersible right before the tragic last dive occurred. And that's why he produced that hit series. Anyway, he came to me and was interested in adapting my book as a screenplay. He's a very talented writer as well. He was a director and producer on the Jeff Corwin Ocean Mysteries series. He's a serious maritime. He's not only a serious showbiz guy. Jude Gerard Press is his name. He's also an ocean guy. So to have his kind of pedigree interested in my Titanic story. So that's in development now. We'll see what happens. I don't know what's going to happen. That's showbiz. But hey, somebody's interested in adapting my story. And I was free to give it to him. Some writers would be like, oh my God, no, I have to do it. You can't. No. And I'm like, no, you know what? Take it. It's all yours. Have at it.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Get it done.
Just get it done. We don't care. But let me go back into the Titanic, because it does hold this fascination, mostly around love and, you know, what people might have been experiencing while they were on the ship at the time. Can you imagine going on a ship to meet your death? Or you're going on a voyage and you don't know if you're going to come back. You're going on a vacation. Do you talk about, or is Netflix interested in the supernatural aspect of what happened in the Titanic? Do people believe the spirits are still down there floating around? Obviously, something is going on because it keeps making itself present in modern day time. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's interesting that the tragedy of Titanic in 1912 was really the 9/11 of its day. It was worldwide news. It was a disaster of epic proportion to have 1,500 people perish on a ship that with all the modern technology, it was unsinkable. God himself could not sink this ship. And then boom, its maiden voyage, that happens. And it affected even the survivors. The survivors did not live happily ever after. They were traumatized from the event. Yeah. They had survivor's guilt, post-traumatic stress. I mean, it was a disaster, which is why it's remarkable that we romanticize it. We don't romanticize earthquakes or 9/11, but something about Titanic is romantic. We think of Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. In my book, it's a fantasy, but it's a scary fantasy. It's a historical fantasy. I don't shy away from that. There are a million stories to tell about Titanic. For every passenger that either died or survived, there's a story. And all the stories of all of their families or witnesses or rescuers. There's no bottom to the well when it comes to stories. So that's my little slice of it. And I think people are drawn to it because it's the ultimate example of hubris. Pride goeth before a fall. And yet with the Titan implosion, 100 years after the Titanic sank, it was the same lesson. This hubris that, oh, I'm going to spend a lot of money and get into this tin can and dive down to the Titanic 2 miles underwater because I can. And nothing bad could happen to me. And we keep repeating the same lessons because we're humans and humans are fallible. And, you know, here we go again. So it's endlessly fascinating. Plus, it's also that Edwardian era. Once the Titanic sunk, it was the end of the Gilded Age and the Edwardian era. And soon after Titanic, when everybody's faith in technology was shaken, we entered World War I. The world changed. So I think that's a lot of the romanticism of Titanic too. It seemed like a more elegant, civilized time. Well, if you were in first class, I mean, let's not talk about the poor folks down in third class.
Oh my gosh.
It wasn't so genteel for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what I want to ask? Weren't the wealthy people, I mean, it was something that a common person wouldn't have been able to afford to take a voyage on the Titanic. Wasn't it a class-based voyage where you had to have a certain amount of money, you had to come from a certain class in order to even board the Titanic? So I thought interesting.
You would need to have money to travel first class, but the ships in those days, the transatlantic liners crossing back and forth from Europe to America, their money was made by the steerage, third class passengers emigrating to America. That's how they made their money. So that's what they could afford to decorate and deck out the first and second class, because they were making the money, the real money, was from the steerage class, the emigrants. So it was a really interesting dichotomy of humanity on those ships. You know, up on the higher decks were the wealthy and the elite,
like,
and down
plane.
In the lower decks were the hard workers. And they're disproportionately, third class did not survive Titanic in the numbers that first class did, because they sent first class to the boats first. And by the time most of the third class passengers got up there, they were out of boats. So that, you know, while the Titanic was certainly a tragedy and a lesson in civilization for sure, some positive things came out about it in terms of shipping safety. The Titanic was not breaking any laws by having too few lifeboats. In fact, the way they determined the number of lifeboats back then was based on the size of the ship. So Titanic actually had more lifeboats than she was legally required to carry. It just wasn't enough. But after the disaster, they changed the rules to ensure there would be more lifeboats. And, you know, they didn't go through the iceberg shipping lanes. They took more southerly routes to avoid that. Plus, communication became better as well.
You know what? Given modern technology, and I'm including AI and all of the bells and whistles that we have, do you feel that the wrecking of the Titanic could have been avoided had we had AI in place at that time, or some kind of inner telescopic things that we could have seen inside? And then what caused it to sink? No, did anybody find out why it sank or what caused it to sink? What happened?
There are many, many conspiracy theories about that. And as far as the technology goes, there are so many what ifs and conspiracy theories and all sorts of things. But you don't even need to think about the what ifs. If we could only have today's technology, would Titanic have sunk? Titanic was a series of mishaps. There was a raging fire going on in the car down in the engine room from the time they left. But they thought, that's all right, we can handle this fire. You know, we can manage the fire. So there was a fire going on the ship as it sailed. The lookouts from the crow's nest they didn't have binoculars. They left them behind. So they were relying solely on their eyes. So they didn't see the iceberg until it was too late because they didn't have the binoculars. They were speeding when they should have been going slower. But they're in the captain's defense. Mm-hmm. They believed that the Titanic was powerful enough to withstand collision. And if the Titanic hadn't turned to the side, and that's it got punctured in the side, if it had hit the iceberg head on, it probably would not have sunk, or at least would have stayed afloat long enough for rescue ships to come, because it was designed that I think four compartments could have flooded, but five would be lethal. And because it hit on the side instead of straight on, more compartments flooded faster, and that's what led to sinking. So you know, there's a zillion what ifs that go into any disaster. You know, hindsight being 2020, we always look back and say, "Oh, if only, if only, if only."
Wow, I just find it interesting that there's so much interest. In something that happened that long ago. And it keeps getting bigger. It's like the more, it's like now that you're out there promoting and then Netflix is gonna push it some more. It's like these young people that I would not think they would have time to be interested in something. It's like a cult following now.
Well, especially in April. I mean, April is Titanic month. And, you know, I launched the book at a Titanic convention on the Queen Mary in Long Beach before I came up to see you in Los Angeles. And now this year, I was fielding offers from various Titanic conventions to come and speak. So I'm doing one in New York this weekend. It's on Sunday, the 12th. Sunday, April 12th. Yes. Here in New York City, I'll be doing the Titanic immersive experience. And it's amazing. You put on the virtual reality glasses and you walk through this room and you are on the ship. You are walking on the promenade of the ship. You are walking through the staterooms, the engine room. And then it's very exciting. You actually can go down to the wreck itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there you can walk around the bottom of the ocean floor and look at the wreck. So I'll be discussing Titanic, signing copies of the book, and people can do this immersive experience. So there's no end. There are Titanic hotels. There are Titanic attractions. People are hungry for it. Every generation, it gets renewed, whether because of a film, because of a documentary, because of it being in the news. It is truly unsinkable. I had an actress friend, Carol Lindley, who was in the film The Poseidon Adventure. And people loved The Poseidon Adventure. Yeah. And they would ask her, why do people love this movie so much? Why do people see it again and again and again and again? And she said, it is the boat that will not sink. And it's true. There's something about a good story. You just hold on to it.
That won't go away. The thing is, too, is that I would think that by now they would have done some kind of horror movie or story around the Titanic, but they haven't gone there yet.
There are dozens of movies about Titanic. There is one called,
horror called Titanic. Stories?
It's called Titanic 666. And it's about a haunted version of Titanic. Yeah. I mean, there's something for everyone. So that's why, you know, my book is the first gay love story from Titanic, because shock horror, there were gay people on the Titanic. What do you know? They had gay people in 1912. But that's an angle of film that has never been exploited or explored before.
Mm-hmm. And I think that would be a good exploration, considering, you know, a lot of people don't know, there were a lot of different kinds of people on the Titanic, I'm sure.
Everywhere.
That people could relate to, like, wow, I didn't even know all that was going on the Titanic. So we've got about a good 15 minutes. I want to tell you to tell, as I started off telling the audience out there, again, you guys, this is my first show doing it in my studio. So the next time I'll have it down, like I forgot to shut the window because I'm used to being in another area of the location where we're on my studio. So don't hold it against me, okay? Don't judge me about it. It's just, I'm just sharpening up my trying to get to where Nelson is, okay? Because he's got his shit together.
I'm in my dining room.
It doesn't matter. You don't. There's no beeping, and I don't hear the airplanes outside.
I live in Harlem. It's constant sirens. And,
oh, okay, yeah, then
church bells. Then you know. And music.
Then you know. You know. You're roughneck. You know.
Well, that's one of the illustrations in Mr. and Mrs. Maple. I incorporate music everywhere in the story because I live over the Apollo Theater. There's New York City is busy and noisy, of course, but because of the Apollo being across the street, we have music at all times of the day and night, whether it's gospel or rap or just somebody driving by. I've got a gorgeous church across the street, so every hour the bells go off. So, you know, if you're going, oh God, not an ambulance or a fire engine, but then
you're in trouble.
You hear the bells. And on Sunday there's gospel everywhere, or, you know, trumpet players.
Blues,
so music is a big part of the story too for Mr. and Mrs. Maple.
I love that. I love that you understand that, because we live in a city. We live in a city. We don't live in a country town. There is no noise. As, like I said, I thought the birds chirping was the alarm. I'm like, well, they're really loud. I thought it was like, they must be really close to the window. But before we go, I would love for you to tell everyone, what is your favorite, biggest Hollywood anecdote that you could tell us, that something happened that we wouldn't have heard of, and that you were there live and in person? Because I know you knew Michael Jackson, you've known all these people. So what would be one of the biggest things that happened to you? Like, welcome to the game. Welcome to the biz.
There's so many, you know. Covering Nicole Kidman's wedding to Keith Urban is a memorable story. And all of these are in the Dancing Between the Raindrops books. You know, the death of Michael Jackson, the death of Robin Williams, the death of Betty White. You know, I became an expert at doing celebrity deaths and covering those. Being able to put things in perspective and while being respectful. But I think the greatest challenge for me in terms of celebrity deaths was 2020. And the people were just, it was February of 2020, and people were just starting to whisper about this flu, this what did they call it? The COVID-19 or whatever the first name of it was. I was covering the Grammy Awards in Los Angeles from the Staples Center. And I got down there early in the morning to get my position on the red carpet. I'm in my tuxedo. I'm preparing to interview all the music stars. And, you know, like the day before, it's award season. So I was getting ready to cover the Oscars. And, you know, it was one thing after the other. And nobody, it was before masks. It turns out it was the last visit to Los Angeles I made before they stopped all the flights and, you know, COVID closed the world. But so I'm there on the Grammys red carpet, ready to do my thing. It's like 10:30 in the morning. And one of my producers comes over to me with, you know, this fallen look on her face. And she goes, I just heard some bad news. I'm like, what is it? And she goes, I don't know what we're going to do. It's going to break any second. I'm like, what is it? She's like, Kobe Bryant has been killed in a helicopter crash, in the plane crash. I remember with his daughter. And I mean, it was so horrible. And the irony is, I was at Staples Center, which is the home of the LA Lakers. And I'm standing there on a red carpet, ready to do the Grammys at Staples Center. And Kobe Bryant has just passed away. And I said, this is going to change the whole event. Nobody's going to want to talk about, you know,
anything
their,
else.
Their album, they're going to want to talk about Kobe. And, you know, my producers were like, what do you know about basketball? And I'm like, not much, but I know about Kobe. He's an icon in Los Angeles. And we're here at Staples Center. This is going to be ground zero for all things Kobe. So leave it with me. It was super challenging, but also very rewarding. And it gives me great satisfaction when I can respectfully cover those stories and give the victims of that accident the respect and sensitivity that, and the families of them, the respect and sensitivity they deserve. So we got through the Grammys, and because we were at Staples Center, we knew that the next day would be thousands of people showing up at Staples Center to tribute Kobe, and the flowers and the t-shirts and the basketballs and you name it. And my friend that helped me break the story, she's like, I've got your position, you're covered. And for 2 days, I stood out in this sea of people covering the tributes to Kobe Bryant for the next 2 days. And that was rewarding for me too, because it wasn't a show business story. This was a story that touched everybody, whether yes. it was entertainment or sports. It was just such a horrible, sad story that I was there with all the really important media of the world, but I had a prime spot. And you enjoyed the experience, but it was very rewarding to have that experience. And then, I think back on it, there I was surrounded by thousands and thousands of people this close to me for all those days. I get on a plane to come home, and little did I know that was going to be, we were going into shutdown. We were going into lockdown.
Wow.
And I think about, and I never even tested positive once for COVID. I danced between the raindrops and never caught COVID. And that's in the Happily Ever After. We covered the whole COVID experience of show business and what it did to the entertainment industry and how we handled it. So, I started broadcasting 4 hours a day through my phone in the little boxes, and you deal with sounds and camera quality, and it's a different world. And that's why when COVID was over and I went back to the studio, all of a sudden they were paying for the studio rental that they never had to pay when it was broadcasting through my phone. That was
great.
Oh,
wow.
And I was like, I need to be in the studio. I can't have my house taken over by a television show for 4 hours. And that was the end of that. They chose the money. They wanted it for free. So
wow.
I don't work for free.
I don't either. Well, you know what? To be honest with you, I used to be I'm still kind-hearted, but I've become very discerning, because I've noticed that when people meet a kind heart, it's so rare, which I didn't know. I didn't know hearts were worth anything back in the day, but I found out they're worth millions of dollars. I'm like, oh my gosh, let me protect my heart and my kind. But I'm glad you said that, because I can tell by the way you write. And when I met you in person, I can feel that heart from you, and I can feel the fairness, and I feel the experience that you have, just the way, you know how people are polished, the way they carry themselves, they kind of float in the room. They don't need a lot of validation, because when they come in the room, that is the validation. They're in the room. So
good,
that's
point.
Kind of how Nelson came up. Nelson, where can we find out more about the trilogy of your books, and why did you name it Dancing Between? I think that is so fabulous. And one reason, it reminds me, it's totally unrelated, but it has related to rain and people being able to move between things. There is a worldwide famous Black pimp named Iceberg Slim. And when he wrote his book, and there was a movie about it too, one of the prostitutes or his girls, she was like, Daddy, oh, Daddy, I can't possibly go out and do what I got to do today because it's raining. It's raining outside. And look at it. He said, B, dance between the raindrops and go out there and give me my money.
That's great.
I thought about that. When you said dancing, I'm like, that's the only ever time I've heard reference to somebody doing something in rain. How do you dance between raindrops?
The title for the books, the trilogy, came from, with the first book, which is just Dancing Between the Raindrops. And that title was the actual words my father spoke to me back in the 80s. I was a teenager. I moved to New York when I was 17 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it was wild. The 80s in New York City were wild.
Studio 54.
Yeah, it was all that. And then it became the era of AIDS. And I was a young gay guy on the loose in New York City.
He's on the loose.
I was on the loose, and I was loose. And I would come home to visit my folks, and they were so, bless their hearts, they were so worried about me. And my dad looked at me and he would shake his head and he said, "I don't know how you survive. It's like you're dancing between the raindrops." And I heard that from my father for years. You're one lucky son of a gun. And my mother would say, "Oh, you know, you were born lucky. You know, not everybody's born lucky. You can make your own luck, but you were just born lucky." And it's true. I don't know how I did it, but I danced between the raindrops. And I wish my dad could see it, that his advice spawned three novels.
Yeah, spawned three books, and look what you did. Look who you gave us. Look who the world, what you produced. And, you know, had you not survived, we would have never gotten to hear your stories or see your wonderful face or feel your smile from across the screen. So I'm glad he did you proud and didn't, you know, stifle you and make you feel weird, you know, because, you know, my mother used to say there's something in the world for everybody. I just don't get it. It bothers me that we have these little teeny weeny minds and the world is this big. How do you fit little teeny minds on a globe that's this big when there's some of everything going on? That's why I always say I'm everywhere at all, where I'm at the same place, same time. And I'm here, I'm where, I'm everywhere at the same time. So where
now
can we
we're taking over the moon so we can spread out a little more.
We can spread out. I love that. I love doing intergalactic thinking, you know. But where can we find more about your books, Dancing Between the Raindrops, Happily Ever After, and the wonderful, the magnificent Mr. I think that's so adorable, Mr. and Mrs. Maple.
Well, it's, you know, God bless Amazon. It's a one-stop shop. Or, you know,
I love Amazon.
I even get my groceries through Amazon.
I do too. I'm hooked.
You know, what can I say? But yes, all 12 of my books are available on Amazon, which is lovely. And my name, which is right up there on the wall behind you, Nelson Aspin. I'm the easiest person in the world to find, nelsonaspin.com. All my social media is Nelson Aspin. And if you want to come to Ireland with me this fall, or if you want to get any of the books, or you want to just find out where I'm showing up next or what I'm up to. Sometimes I think I just posted something about the soup that I've got simmering on the stove. You know, it's a one-stop emporium. No. It's just simmering away. It's bubbling away. Okay. It's a lovely white bean and spinach vegetarian soup that I decided. I needed some healthy stuff.
It sounds nourishing. It sounds nourishing.
The trick, Osiris, is to put in a lot of cannellini beans because that makes you full. Fiber.
And they're teeny little white beans. You know, I used to get cannellini and navy beans mixed up because they're both white, but the cannellini are really different than the other beans too.
Well, my father, that bastion of knowledge, Dancing Between the Raindrops, used to say, beans, the magical fruit. The more you eat, the more you toot.
Well, I'll make sure not to get my dog any of them because he toots quite a bit. But anyway, Nelson, my love, my darling, I know a lot of people wonder, you know, when people come on here from different lifestyles, but I will tell you that I'm an honorary member, and I'm saying this out in the public, I don't care what you think, of the LGBTQIA+ community. They were the only ones that took care of me when I couldn't find a job. They encouraged me to be a model, telling me that I was fierce when I thought I was some little country black girl that had never gone anywhere. They encouraged me to paint. Everything that I've been encouraged to do came out of the other communities because I never fit the regular community. I'm a little quirky. I'm a little odd. I don't fit in a box. I don't look like people what they supposed to look like, and I don't care. I'm so happy that I didn't buy into all of those versions of myself that other people wanted me to be, and that I found the version of myself that only I can be.
That's all you can be. All you can be is yourself. If you want to be happily ever after, you just have to be you.
I salute you for making it through and for bringing us such wonderful treasures and for your love story in the Titanic. I think that's so amazing. And you know, somebody's going to pick that up. You wait. My intuition tells me.
From your lips.
Somebody's going to grab it. Well, it's going to Netflix. It's not.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. The screenwriter is amazing. And he had such success at Netflix. That would be a great fit. But hey, I want to get it out there. That's if anybody who buys any one of my books, I'm so honored. It was like, you know, I did morning television for 30 years. I always felt it was a privilege. It was a privilege to be invited into someone's home at that intimate time of day when they're getting ready or they're just waking up or they're getting the kids off to school, what have you. That it's a very private time of day. So to be invited into people's homes every morning for 30 years, and I feel that way about the books. Anybody that buys any one of my books, I'm so honored that you've taken the time to read what I took so much time to write.
Okay. Well, we got to go. Shout out to Sam Hassan, LA Talk Radio. Love you from my heart. He's a wonderful person. He does a great job supporting me and allowing us to shine every week. Shout out to those of you out there who watch the show. Come and support me. I love you. Love you for who you are, that you stand for yourself. And I like you because you're wonderful human beings that wouldn't dare put anyone down or judge anyone. That's why we're luminaries. We don't judge. We help and support and assist. We don't judge. And then if you want to reach me, my IG tag is Osiris_Munir_the painter. I'm all over the place. Just Google my name. You'll see everything I'm doing. And don't forget to smile. It works wonders. Bye, sugar. Mwah. Love you guys. Bye. Bye, Nelson. Thank you for coming on to the show. Bye.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.